Rahula Sutta. For those who have the book, this is on page 38. And I'll just summarize what we covered so far. Okay, Rahula was the son of the Buddha. And after the Buddha attained enlightenment and came back to his home city of Kapilavastu, little Rahula, who was then 7 years old, came out to greet him, and the Buddha had him ordained as a novice. Rahula then became the first novice monk in Buddha's history. And as Rahula grew up and developed in his life as a monk, the Buddha frequently recited some verses or gave him some teachings, which probably later became reformulated in the form of verses that would be easy to memorize. And these verses have come down in the form of the Rahula Sutta. And I explained last time that these verses form a very concise, systematic, step-by-step instruction in the practical training of a Buddhist monastic, from the very elementary stages, very beginning stages, all the ways to the final stage, the completion stage of the practice. And so last time I dealt with the early verses, the beginning verses, which deal with the first steps to be undertaken in going forth in the homeless life, which means after one gives up the pleasures of the senses to enter the homeless life out of faith, the Buddha advises Rahula to associate with good friends, with noble friends, then to resort to a remote dwelling place, a quiet and secluded place, suitable for living the spiritual life. He advises him to be moderate in eating. I think that's what I dealt with so far last time. Okay, now we come to verse 339, which deals with the proper use of the requisites of the monk's life. These are the four requisites, which are the robes, food, dwelling place, and medicines. Traditionally, these are said to be the four supports for leading the monastic life. And in the suttas, we have special recollections or reflections given for the use of each of these requisites. And so when we begin our training as a monk, we're taught to do these reflections every day. In fact, in the Theravada tradition, in the usual liturgy that is done in the morning and the evening, the reflections on the use of the four requisites are included in these liturgies, so that we do the reflection on the use of the robe, that one uses the robe just for the sake of covering up the body, for protecting it against heat, against cold, to protect it from the touch of the insects, serpents, and for covering up the private parts. Then one uses the alms food not for enjoyment, not for intoxication with taste, not for making the body become strong and beautiful, but for the purpose of supporting life, maintaining life, keeping oneself in a healthy condition, and for living the spiritual life. And then we use a lodging, a dwelling place, again for the purpose of keeping off the cold, keeping out the heat, and for enjoying solitude. Okay, and what the Buddha emphasizes in the training is to be content with these basic requisites, not to be craving after luxuries, and not to be obsessed with particular types of the requisites. Like, for example, because one gives up worldly luxuries, so then the mind starts becoming obsessed with getting a particular type of robe. Like one likes a particular color, but even though there's not many styles, but but one likes a particular material, high quality material, particular color, particular cut. And then some go seeking in improper ways the particular type of robe that they want. But what the Buddha teaches is to be content with any kind of monastic robe. Of course, it has to be the proper kind of monastic robe that's cut in the right way, dyed the right kind of color. And then what he says is that one should not search in the wrong way for a robe, for food, for a dwelling place, for other requisites. And when one gets the kind of requisite that one wants, then one shouldn't be bound to it. One shouldn't be tied to it and infatuated with it. But one sees what is called the danger or the shortcomings in it, that whatever one gets is impermanent. It's not going to give one lasting satisfaction. And one understands what is called the escape, that is, the release from it. That is, one puts away the attachment to it, and one just uses it as a support or means for leading this spiritual life properly. So in that way, these four means of support become aids or pillars for leading the religious life and not objects of obsession. And in the Buddha's time, the things for which a person could crave were very limited. But nowadays, I have to say rather sadly, the things for which monastics crave, the possibilities have expanded immensely. So sometimes monks have to have, I'm sad to say this, but television set, hi-fi radio, hi-fi is out of, that's gone already. Did I say? Hi-fi radio, wow, I'm back in the 1950s. Trips to, they want to go pleasure trips here, there, haven't seen this country yet, haven't seen that country yet, please give me a ticket here, give me a ticket there. Of course, often monks, they have to use cars for driving in the West, but some car monks not content with any kind of car, but even in Asia, the monks, they don't drive themselves, but monasteries, they get offered cars by people with the driver, a lay person driving. And the better monasteries won't be content with Japanese-built car or Korean-built car, but only Mercedes will do. Yeah. But the ideal way to live the monastic life is to be content with as simple the requisites as possible. And so the ideal way, I sometimes have spoken about a German monk who lived in Sri Lanka who passed away, wow, it's just about 1 year now. He traveled for 1964 to 1987, 23 years, without even a regular monastery or dwelling place. But after he completed his basic monastic training of 12 years, he would always travel throughout 8 months of the year, 8 or 9 months, apart from the 3 months of the rainy season, without any fixed residence, with just his travel bag, just a shoulder bag. He would go walking through the whole island of Sri Lanka from place to place. He would stay wherever he found himself that night, and then the next day walk on, going for alms round. If he found a nice place in the forest monastery, he might stay for a few weeks, build up some momentum in his meditation, and then go on walking. Okay, so not to have craving or attachment to these four requisites. And then the Buddha says, do not be one who returns to this world. This is very powerful advice. Ma lokam punar agami. And here when the Buddha is speaking about this world, he's referring to this world of samsara, this round of birth and death. And so the Buddha says that this samsara, this round of birth and death, is without any discoverable beginning in time, that there's no first point to our traveling on in this samsara. But through beginningless time, we've been going from life to life, pulled on by craving, blinded by ignorance. And he says that as we've passed on in this samsara, even in one world period, in one world cycle, pile of bones that we've left behind, if we were to take the bones, collect them together to make a heap or a pile, that pile would be as big as a particular mountain that was in the state of Magadha in India called Mount Vepula, a very big mountain. And why is this? Even we take the bones that we have in one body, they don't seem to be very much. But life after life after life, we leave behind these bones, we put them all together, they form a gigantic mountain. And so when one reflects like this, we see how pointless is this wandering on from one life to the next, just leaving behind body after body after body, experiencing sometimes a little happiness here, some joy there, but then experiencing old age, sickness, death, experiencing suffering, anguish, disappointment. And so the Buddha says that this is a reason, when one reflects in this way, this gives one a reason, a motivation for developing this thought, this idea of not wanting to come back to this world again. Okay, now we go on to verse 6. 6 of the Sutta, 340 in Sutta Nipata. Sangvuto pati mokasmin indriyesu cha panchasu sati kaya gata tyatu nibida bahulo bhava. First, have restraint according to the disciplinary code or monastic code. The monastic code is what is called in Pali the Patimokkha. This is the code of rules that the Buddha has laid down for the guidance of the monks. And so the Buddha is advising Rahula. At this time, he must have been not a novice anymore, but already fully ordained as a bhikkhu, so over the age of 20. So, in the beginning, the Buddha didn't lay down formal monastic rules, but there was a kind of unspoken code of conduct, and all of the monks just naturally conformed to the right rules, the right guidelines of conduct for an ascetic. But then as time went on within the life of the monastic order, monks started to break this unformulated code of conduct. And so the Buddha, as one incident after another started to take place, the Buddha had to lay down these formal rules of conduct until, by the end of his lifetime, a code of some 150 formal rules of conduct had evolved. And that is called the Patimokkha. And then other little guidelines came to be added to this. So now we have a full code of some 227, 250 rules of conduct, which is called the Patimokkha. Okay, the right conduct according to the Patimokkha, this is one aspect of moral discipline. But another aspect of moral discipline, a more inward aspect, is restraint over the sense faculties. Venerable Xinxing has spoken about this several times in lectures in more detail. Now we have the five physical sense faculties and the mind faculty, which each take their own sense objects. The eye sees forms, ear hears sounds, nose smells odors, the tongue experiences tastes, the body experiences tactile objects, and the inner mental faculty experiences the outer objects as well, and then its own objects, ideas, images, and so on. And these objects of the senses, usually they can be either pleasant or painful objects. Pleasant or, let's say, agreeable or disagreeable objects. And the agreeable objects will give rise to pleasure, pleasant feelings. The disagreeable objects will give rise to painful feelings. And if we're not exercising restraint over the senses, the pleasant feelings will trigger off liking or attachment, liking or desire, craving. And the disagreeable objects, the painful feelings, will trigger off aversion or resentment or repulsion. And so in this way, in our day-to-day life, we're usually oscillating or vacillating, oscillating is a better word, between these two binary reactions of liking the pleasant, disliking the unpleasant, being attracted to what is agreeable, being repelled by what is disagreeable. And this is, you call this the whirlpool of the mind, swinging back and forth, or being swirled around and around between the pleasant and the unpleasant, the agreeable and the disagreeable. And we cannot stop this by changing the outer world. The outer world will always be dominated by these pairs of opposite qualities. The only way we can stop being swept away by the whirlpool is by changing the reactions of the mind. And the first step in changing the reaction is to exercise restraint over the senses. When experiencing forms with the eye, if it's a pleasant form, one knows it's a pleasant form, but one doesn't let the mind latch onto it with craving and attachment. One doesn't build up desires and fantasies and erect these castles of craving upon the foundation of pleasant sensations, pleasant objects. And when there are disagreeable experiences, disagreeable encounters, disagreeable sensations, disagreeable relationships, one doesn't build up reactions of aversion, relationships governed by resentment. But one exercises control over the senses, control over the mind in the way it relates to these experiences. So it's first, the verse actually says, indriyesu cha panchasu, in the five faculties. So here it's talking about restraint in the five sense faculties. But actually, when the suttas explain restraint over the senses, they also speak about restraint over the sixth faculty, restraint over the mind faculty. Okay, the next line in the same verse says to be mindful of the body. Actually, it says, let your mindfulness go to the body. This is a kind of training for a monastic person in this person's day-to-day life. Let the mind be centered on the body so that when one is engaged in various activities, the mind is not wandering outside here and there, but is centered on the body. And one is aware of what one is doing, clearly comprehending what one is doing. But this expression, mindfulness gone to the body, kayagata sati, eventually comes to incorporate a very wide range of meditation subjects which are involved with the body, so that we have in the Majjhima Nikaya a sutta called Kayagata Sati Sutta. This is sutta number 119 of the Middle Length Discourses, in which quite a range of meditation subjects are categorized as types of mindfulness concerning the body. Mindfulness of breathing, mindfulness of the parts of the body, mindfulness of the four elements, mindfulness of walking, the walking meditation, clear comprehension of one's various activities. But I think in this context, it might be best to consider it as simply having the mindfulness centered upon the body in one's day-to-day activities. I think with this meaning, it goes along with being observing the restraint of the monastic code and being restrained in the five senses. And then the Buddha says, be full of disenchantment with the world. The translator here says, continually develop dispassion. But I don't really like dispassion as a translation for nibbida. I prefer disenchantment. The word nibbida actually comes from the root vid, which means to know. and near gives the sense of out, so nibbida has the sense of finding out. So this is the reaction that takes place when one finds out the real nature of things. One becomes disillusioned with things about which one has had disillusion. One becomes disillusioned with things about which one has been entertaining illusions. And so, when one has been having illusions, especially about the world as being beautiful, delightful, pleasurable, and then one starts to see into the impermanent, unsatisfactory, insubstantial nature of the world, then one becomes disillusioned with it or disenchanted with it. And there's an interesting sutta that I found in the Samyutta Nikaya where the Buddha says, this is in the Kanda Samyutta, chapter 22, sutta number 30. The Buddha says, if bodily form were entirely pleasurable, immersed in pleasure, steeped in pleasure, and if it were not also steeped in dukkha, in suffering, beings would not experience revulsion towards it or disenchantment with it. The first part of the quote says, if physical form, bodily form, were exclusively painful, immersed in pain, steeped in pain, and if it were not also steeped in pleasure, beings would not become attached to it. But it is because bodily form is pleasurable, immersed in pleasure, steeped in pleasure, and is not steeped only in suffering, that people become attached to it. That's the first part of the quote. But then the Buddha goes on to say that if physical form were exclusively pleasurable, immersed only in pleasure and steeped only in pleasure, and if it were not also steeped in suffering, beings would not become disenchanted with it. But it is because the bodily form is subject to suffering, immersed in suffering, and is not steeped only in pleasure, that people become disenchanted with it. Then when they become disenchanted, then they become dispassionate towards it. And through dispassion, they are purified. So we have this dual nature of all the phenomena of the world. There's the enjoyable aspect, which leads to attachment when one doesn't see things accurately. But when one sees through that enjoyable exterior into the unpleasant aspect, then one becomes disenchanted and turns the mind to renunciation, to relinquishment, towards liberation. Okay, now in the next verse, the Buddha takes the teaching to a deeper level. This is verse 7. I like to recite the Pali. Nimittang parivajehi subang rag upasanghitang asubhaya chitang bhavehi ekagang susamahitang. Okay, one should avoid the sign that is attractive, connected with sensual lust. Cultivate, develop the mind on the unattractive. Make it one-pointed and well-concentrated. Okay, here the Buddha is giving instructions for the development of samadhi. This is unification of mind, concentration of mind, based upon the asubha kamatana, that is the using the impure nature of the body or the unattractive nature of the body as the meditation subject. And probably the Buddha is using this specific meditation subject for Rahula, because Rahula is now a young monk, maybe he's just 20, 21 years old, still full of life, still full of vitality, and the Buddha has to train him to subdue the mind that will be attracted to thoughts of sensuality, sexual thoughts. Now, what is meant here by this word nimittam, the signs that are connected with raga, with sensual lust? Okay, these are features or aspects of things that appear to us that provoke or stimulate sensual desire, especially in this case, sexual desire. This would be, for a male, that would be the features of a female that are beautiful and attractive, the form, the voice, manners, and so on. For a female, for a woman, it would be the features of a male that are attractive. Again, the physical form, the voice, manners, and so on. Now, if the mind fastens upon these things, the senses fix upon these things, the mind dwells on them, then this is what causes sensual desire to arise and to become stronger. This is like when one has a little fire burning in a fireplace. This is like taking first twigs and putting it on the fire. Then when the fire is burning a little stronger, it's like taking logs and putting it on the fire until the fire starts blazing and glowing and burning very strong. So that's the experience through the senses that gives fuel to the mind, for the mind to consume, for the latent tendencies, the underlying tendencies of sensuality to consume the fuel of sense experience. Then those latent tendencies of sensual desire burn that fuel and they start flaring up and burning brightly until they consume the mind, and the mind becomes obsessed and overrun by sensual thoughts. And for a young monastic person, that creates a great deal of inner turmoil, and in many cases it leads a monastic person to think the monastic life too difficult, better to return to lay life. And so the training that the Buddha gives, it's not to fight against sexual desire, not to suppress it forcefully, but to train the mind not to fasten upon the enticing, intoxicating objects of the senses that feed, that nourish the sensual desire. And then to train the mind again to dwell upon those aspects of bodily existence that are not so beautiful and attractive. This is what is called asubha. Literally, it's the unbeautiful or unattractive nature of the body. And this is usually practiced by way of the meditation on the 32 parts of the body. One begins with one's own body, because it's not safe to begin taking the body of for a young monk to sit there and think, I'm going to practice this, and take the body of my beloved, the nice young girl that I've seen in the village on my arms round, and I'll take her as my object of meditation, and start thinking about how impure her body is. And then before long, tomorrow I'll have to find out her phone number, email address. But one begins with one's own body, starting with the parts that immediately visible, head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin. The way recommended in Visuddhimagga, one takes 5-6 parts at a time, going in forward and backward order. Skin, teeth, nails, body hairs, hairs of the head. Then one works with those back and forth till one gets familiar with them. And actually, if one reflects, one thinks when one sees another person, what one is seeing all the time, what is it that's so beautiful and attractive? The most beautiful models, the most supermodels, the most beautiful movie actresses, the most handsome and attractive sports stars, movie actors, what one is seeing all the time with one's eyes, what is it? Head hairs, body hairs, fingernails, teeth, skin. That's all that is one sees. Then one goes beneath the skin, muscles, ligaments, bones, bone marrow. And the Visuddhimagga puts kidneys there, but I prefer to keep it for the next group. Then bone marrow, bones, ligaments, muscles. Getting familiar with that. I won't cover all the groups. That takes a full period, full hour to explain. But when it starts bringing in the different parts, like heart, liver, lungs, then intestine, stomach, then the fluid parts, bile, pus, phlegm, blood, sweat, fat, and so on, till one is going through all of these parts, forward order, reverse order, till one takes the whole body is just a collection of these 32 parts. And and then as one goes through this asubha nature of the body, starts to stand out and become clear, until one could focus the mind on that ekagang su samahitang, one-pointed, well-concentrated. The mind is now fixed on this in a state of samadhi. It's not just going back and forth amongst different parts, but just fixed upon that unattractive nature of the body in a state of deep samadhi. And from there it can move into other meditation subjects, which will bring it to deeper states of samadhi. Okay, then the next verse. Animitancha bhavehi mananu sayang ujaha tato manabi samaya upasanto charisasiti. Here I don't agree with this translation. Meditate on the signless, yes, but I don't agree with putting Nibbana there. And then for the next line, let me just give my own translation. Okay. And continuing, and develop or cultivate the signless and uproot the underlying tendency to conceit, then through the penetration of conceit or by breaking through conceit, you will wander peacefully. Here the Buddha is telling Rahula to develop the signless meditation. The translator, Venerable Saddhatisa, identifies that with Nibbana, but I don't think this is the case, because we find in the suttas sometimes mention is made of a state called the signless meditation, from which it's sometimes said that the meditator falls away from that signless meditation by paying attention to signs. And it's not really, I have to say, from the suttas themselves, it's not very clear what is meant by the signless meditation. This is wu xiang ding in Chinese. But according to the Pali commentaries, this is the samadhi which develops on the basis of insight meditation. It's the state of samadhi which develops through deep insight into the impermanence of all conditioned formations. And so when the mind becomes absorbed through direct experience into the momentary breaking up and passing away of all conditioned formations, then the sign of substantial existence, or the features of substantial existence that ordinarily cover up our perception, disappear, so that the mind is just completely immersed in this perception of experience or of all of existence as this process of phenomena breaking up and passing away, breaking up and passing away, moment after moment after moment. Through direct experience, one goes into this flux of formations which are dissolving and breaking and dissolving, breaking up and dissolving. And so there's no more perception of things as being solid, substantial, truly existent. And it's when this samadhi, based on insight, reaches its culmination that one can make the breakthrough to the supramundane or world-transcending realization. But if one doesn't sustain that samadhi, but one starts fixing upon the solid or substantial appearance of things, that one falls away from it, and then one loses that signless concentration. Okay, but supposing that one sustains the signless concentration, then one will break through to the world-transcending realization through which one can eliminate the underlying tendencies. And it's interesting that in the case of Rahula, the Buddha mentions the underlying tendency to conceit. And there's, a reason why the Buddha mentions this. And that is because Rahula, first of all, was born into the royal family. One thing, he was the son of the Buddha. So in the line of the Sakyan descent. And then also, as the son of the Buddha, even as a young monk, Rahula thinks, the Buddha is my father. How great I must be. Because everybody is respecting, revering, venerating the Buddha, and I'm right behind him, his own son, so I must be somebody special too. And it's also said that Rahula, like the Buddha, was very handsome, and he had those princely characteristics that the Buddha had. And so the Buddha sometimes would have to give Rahula sometimes a severe exhortation not to be proud of his family descent, not to be proud of his bodily features. And here he speaks about uprooting this latent tendency to conceit. And this subtlest form of conceit is the conceit I am. And that is fully eliminated only at the stage of arahatship. And so this is what is indicated by the third line. By breaking through conceit, by penetrating this subtle conceit, I am, then all the other delusions and defilements which revolve around that notion, I am, all of them will fall away together with conceit. And when that subtle, when all of those defilements fall away, then you will live peacefully, you'll be able to wander peacefully. Okay, and that is the end of the Rahula Sutta. So you see the way the sutta goes all the ways from the very first step of leaving the household life, then it comes to the culmination in arhatship. Okay, thank you all for your attention. And may the blessings of the Triple Gem be with you all. Okay, we end by sharing the merits. Akasata ca bhumata Devanaga mahidika Panyantang anumoditva Chirang rakantu sasanam Akasata ca bhumata Devanaga mahidika Panyantang anumoditva Chirang rakantu desanam akasata ca bhumata devanaga mahidika panyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mangparam etavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe sata anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya bhavagupadaya avicihetato etantare satakai upapanna rupi arupi ca asanya sanyino dukkha pamucantu pusantu nibbutin.